postponement. 1 week before the date set for the wedding, little Remedios woke up in the middle of the night, soaked in a hot broth which had exploded in her insides with a kind of tearing belch, and she died 3 days later, poisoned by her own blood, with a pair of twins crossed in her stomach. Amaranta suffered a crisis of conscience. She had begged God with such fervor for something fearful to happen so that she would not have to poison Rebecca, that she felt guilty of Remedios' death. That was not the obstacle that she had begged for so much. Remedios had brought a breath of merriment to the house. She had settled down with her husband in a room near the workshop, which she decorated with the dolls and toys of her recent childhood, and her merry vitality overflowed the four walls of the bedroom and went like a whirlwind of good health along the porch with the begonias. She would start singing at dawn. She was the only person who dared intervene in the arguments between Rebecca and Amaranta. She plunged into the fatiguing chore of taking care of José Arcadio Buendía. She would bring him his food. She would help him with his daily necessities, wash him with soap and a scrubbing brush, keep his hair and beard free of lice and nits, keep the palm shelter in good condition, and reinforce it with waterproof canvas in stormy weather. In her last months, she had succeeded in communicating with him in phrases of rudimentary Latin. When the son of Araliano and Pilar Tenera was born and brought to the house and baptized in an intimate ceremony with the name Aureliano José, Remedios decided that he would be considered their oldest child. Her maternal instinct surprised Ursula. Aureliano, for his part, found in her the justification that he needed to live. He worked all day in his workshop, and Remedios would bring him a cup of black coffee in the middle of the morning. They would both visit the Mascotes every night. Aureliano would play endless games of dominoes with his father-in-law, while Remedios chatted with her sisters, or talked to her mother about more important things. The link with the Buendías consolidated Don Apolinar Mascotes' authority in the town. On frequent trips to the capital of the province, he succeeded in getting the government to build a school, so that Arcadio, who had inherited the educational enthusiasm of his grandfather, could take charge of it. Through persuasion, he managed to get the majority of houses painted blue in time for the date of national independence. At the urging of Father Nicanor, he arranged for the transfer of Caterino's store to a back street, and he closed down several scandalous establishments that prospered in the center of town. Once he returned with 6 policemen armed with rifles, to whom he entrusted the maintenance of order, and no one remembered the original agreement not to have armed men in the town. Aureliano enjoyed his father-in-law's efficiency. "You're going to get as fat as he is," his friends would say to him. But his sedentary life, which accentuated his cheekbones and concentrated the sparkle of his eyes, did not increase his weight or alter the parsimony of his character, but, on the contrary, it hardened on his lips the straight line of solitary meditation and implacable decision. So deep was the affection that he and his wife had succeeded in arousing in both their families that when Remedios announced that she was going to have a child, even Rebecca and Amaranta declared a truce in order to knit items in blue wool if it was to be a boy, and in pink wool in case it was a girl. She was the last person Arcadio thought about a few years later, when he faced the firing squad. Ursula ordered a morning period of closed doors and windows, with no one entering or leaving except on matters of utmost necessity. She prohibited any talking aloud for a year, and she put Remedios' daguerreotype in the place where her body had been laid out, with a black ribbon around it and an oil lamp that was always kept lighted. Future generations, who never let the lamp go out, would be puzzled at that girl in a pleated skirt, white boots, and with an organdy band around her head, and they were never able to connect her with the standard image of a great-grandmother. Amaranta took charge of Aureliano José. She adopted him as a son who would share her solitude and relieve her from the involuntary laudanum that her mad beseeching had thrown into Remedios' coffee. Pietro Crespi would tiptoe in at dusk, with a black ribbon on his hat, and he would pay a silent visit to Rebecca, who seemed to be bleeding to death inside the black dress with sleeves down to her wrists. Just the idea of thinking about a new date for the wedding would have been so irreverent that the engagement turned into an eternal relationship, a fatigued love that no one worried about again, as if the lovers, who in other days had sabotaged the lamps in order to kiss, had been abandoned to the free will of death. Having lost her bearings, completely demoralized, Rebecca began eating earth again. Suddenly, when the morning had gone on so long that the needlepoint sessions began again, someone pushed open the street door at 2 in the afternoon, in the mortal silence of the heat, and the braces in the foundation shook with such force that Amaranta and her friends, sewing on the porch, Rebecca sucking her finger in her bedroom, Ursula in the kitchen, Aureliano in the workshop, and even José Arcadio Buendía, under the solitary chestnut tree, had the impression that an earthquake was breaking up the house. A huge man had arrived. His square shoulders barely fitted through the doorways. He was wearing a medal of Our Lady of Help around his bison neck. His arms and chest were completely covered with cryptic tattooing, and on his right wrist was the tight copper bracelet of the Niño Sin Cruz amulet. His skin was tanned by the salt of the open air. His hair was short and straight like the mane of a mule. His jaws were of iron, and he wore a sad smile. He had a belt on that was twice as thick as the cinch of a horse, boots with leggings and spurs and iron on the heels, and his presence gave the quaking impression of a seismic tremor. He went through the parlor and the living room, carrying some half-worn saddlebags in his hand, and he appeared like a thunderclap on the porch with the begonias, where Amaranta and her friends were paralyzed, their needles in the air. "Hello," he said to them in a tired voice, threw the saddlebags on a work table, and went by on his way to the back of the house. "Hello," he said to the startled Rebecca, who saw him pass by the door of her bedroom. "Hello," he said to Aureliano, who was at his silversmith's bench with all 5 senses alert. He did not linger with anyone. He went directly to the kitchen, and there he stopped for the first time at the end of a trip that had begun on the other side of the world. "Hello," he said. Ursula stood for a fraction of a second with her mouth open, looked into his eyes, gave a cry, and flung her arms around his neck, shouting and weeping with joy. It was José Arcadio. He was returning as poor as when he had left, to such an extreme that Ursula had to give him 2 pesos to pay for the rental of his horse. He spoke a Spanish that was larded with sailor slang. They asked where he had been, and he answered, "Out there." He hung his hammock in the room they assigned him and slept for 3 days. When he woke up, after eating 16 raw eggs, he went directly to Caterino's store, where his monumental size provoked a panic of curiosity among the women. He called for music and cane liquor for everyone to be put on his bill. He would Indian wrestle with 5 men at the same time. "It can't be done," they said, convinced that they would not be able to move his arm. "He has niños en cruz." Caterino, who did not believe in magical tricks of strength, bet him 12 pesos that he could not move the counter. José Arcadio pulled it out of its place, lifted it over his head, and put it in the street. It took 11 men to put it back. In the heat of the party, he exhibited his unusual masculinity on the bar, completely covered with tattoos of words in several languages intertwined in blue and red. To the women who were besieging him and coveting him, he put the question as to who would pay the most. The one who had the most money offered him 20 pesos. Then he proposed raffling himself off among them at 10 pesos a chance. It was a fantastic price, because the most sought-after woman earned 8 pesos a night. But they all accepted. They wrote their names on 14 pieces of paper, which they put into a hat, and each woman took one out. When there were only 2 pieces left to draw, it was established to whom they belonged. 5 pesos more from each one," José Arcadio proposed, "and I'll share myself with both." He made his living that way. He had been around the world 65 times, enlisted in a crew of sailors without a country. The women who went to bed with him that night in Caterino's store brought him naked into the dance salon so that people could see that there was not a square inch of his body that was not tattooed, front and back, and from his neck to his toes. He did not succeed in becoming incorporated into the family. He slept all day and spent the night in the red light district, making bets on his strength. On the rare occasions when Ursula got him to sit down at the table, he gave signs of radiant good humor. especially when he told about his adventures in remote countries. He had been shipwrecked and spent 2 weeks adrift in the Sea of Japan, feeding on the body of a comrade who had succumbed to sunstroke, and whose extremely salty flesh, as it cooked in the sun, had a sweet and granular taste. Under a bright noonday sun in the Gulf of Bengal, his ship had killed a sea dragon, in the stomach of which they found the helmet, the buckles, and the weapons of a crusader. In the Caribbean he had seen the ghost of the pirate ship of Victor Hugues, with its sails torn by the winds of death, the masts chewed by sea worms, and still looking for the course to Guadeloupe. Ursula would weep at the table as if she were reading the letters that had never arrived, and in which José Arcadio told about his deeds and misadventures. "And there was so much of a home here for you, my son," she would sob, "and so much food thrown to the hogs." But underneath it all she could not conceive that the boy the gypsies took away was the same lout who would eat half a suckling pig for lunch, and whose flatulence withered the flowers. Something similar took place with the rest of the family. Amaranta could not conceal the repugnance that she felt at the table because of his bestial belching. Arcadio, who never knew the secret of their relationship, scarcely answered the questions that he asked with the obvious idea of gaining his affection. Aureliano tried to relive the times when they slept in the same room, tried to revive the complicity of childhood, but José Arcadio had forgotten about it, because life at sea had saturated his memory with too many things to remember. Only Rebecca succumbed to the first impact. The day that she saw him pass by her bedroom, she thought that Pietro Crespi was a sugary dandy next to that proto-male, whose volcanic breathing could be heard all over the house. She tried to get near him under any pretext. On a certain occasion, José Arcadio looked at her body with shameless attention and said to her, "You're a woman, little sister." Rebecca lost control of herself. She went back to eating earth and the whitewash on the walls with the avidity of previous days, and she sucked her finger with so much anxiety that she developed a callus on her thumb. She vomited up a green liquid with dead leeches in it. She spent nights awake shaking with fever, fighting against delirium, waiting until the house shook with the return of José Arcadio at dawn. One afternoon, when everyone was having a siesta, she could no longer resist and went to his bedroom. She found him in his shorts, lying in the hammock that he had hung from the beams with a ship's hawser. She was so impressed by his enormous, motley nakedness that she felt an impulse to retreat.
"Excuse me," she said, "I didn't know you were here."
But she lowered her voice so as not to wake anyone up.
"Come here," he said.
Rebecca obeyed. She stopped beside the hammock in an icy sweat, feeling knots forming in her intestines, while José Arcadio stroked her ankles with the tips of his fingers, then her calves, then her thighs, murmuring, "Oh, little sister, little sister." She had to make a supernatural effort not to die when a startlingly regulated cyclonic power lifted her up by the waist and despoiled her of her intimacy with 3 slashes of its claws and quartered her like a little bird. She managed to thank God for having been born before she lost herself in the inconceivable pleasure of that unbearable pain, splashing in the steaming marsh of the hammock which absorbed the explosion of blood like a blotter. 3 days later, they were married during the 5 o'clock mass. José Arcadio had gone to Pietro Crespi's store the day before. He found him giving a zither lesson and did not draw him aside to speak to him. "I'm going to marry Rebecca," he told him. Pietro Crespi turned pale, gave the zither to one of his pupils, and dismissed the class. When they were alone in the room that was crowded with musical instruments and mechanical toys, Pietro Crespi said,
"She's your sister." "I don't care,"
José Arcadio replied. Pietro Crespi mopped his brow with the handkerchief that was soaked in lavender.
"It's against nature," he explained, "and besides, it's against the law."
José Arcadio grew impatient, not so much at the argument, as over Pietro Crespi's paleness.
"Fuck nature 2 times over, he said, "and I've come to tell you not to bother going to ask Rebecca anything."
But his brutal deportment broke down when he saw Pietro Crespi's eyes grow moist.
"Now," he said to him in a different tone, "if you really like the family, there's Amaranta for you." Father Nicanor revealed in his Sunday sermon that Jose Arcadio and Rebecca were not brother and sister. Ursula never forgave what she considered an inconceivable lack of respect, and when they came back from the church, she forbade the newlyweds to set foot in the house again. For her, it was as if they were dead. So they rented a house across from the cemetery and established themselves there with no other furniture but Jose Arcadio's hammock. On their wedding night, a scorpion that had got into her slipper bit Rebecca on the foot. Her tongue went to sleep, but that did not stop them from spending a scandalous honeymoon. The neighbors were startled by the cries that woke up the whole district as many as 8 times in a single night, and 3 times during siesta, and they prayed that such wild passion would not disturb the peace of the dead. Aureliano was the only one who was concerned about them. He bought them some furniture and gave them some money until Jose Arcadio recovered his sense of reality and began to work the no-man's land that bordered the courtyard of the house. Amaranta, on the other hand, never did overcome her rancor against Rebecca, even though life offered her a satisfaction of which she had not dreamed. At the initiative of Ursula, who did not know how to repair the shame, Pietro Crespi continued having lunch at the house on Tuesdays, rising above his defeat with a serene dignity. He still wore the black ribbon on his hat as a sign of respect for the family, and he took pleasure in showing his affection for Ursula by bringing her exotic gifts, Portuguese sardines, Turkish rose marmalade, and on one occasion a lovely Manila shawl. Amaranta looked after him with a loving diligence. She anticipated his wants, pulled out the threads of the cuffs of his shirt, and embroidered a dozen handkerchiefs with his initials for his birthday. On Tuesdays, after lunch, while she would embroider on the porch, he would keep her happy company. For Pietro Crespi, that woman whom he always had considered and treated as a child, was a revelation. Although her temperament lacked grace, she had a rare sensibility for appreciating the things of the world, and had a secret tenderness. One Tuesday, when no one doubted that sooner or later it had to happen, Pietro Crespi asked her to marry him. She did not stop her work. She waited for the hot blush to leave her ears, and gave her voice a serene stress of maturity. "Of course, Crespi," she said, "but when we know each other better, it's never good to be hasty in things." Ursula was confused. In spite of the esteem she had for Pietro Crespi, she could not tell whether his decision was good or bad from the moral point of view after his prolonged and famous engagement to Rebecca, but she finally accepted it as an unqualified fact, because no one shared her doubts. Aureliano, who was the man of the house, confused her further with his enigmatic and final opinion. "These are not times to go around thinking about weddings." That opinion, which Ursula understood only some months later, was the only sincere one that Aureliano could express at that moment, not only with respect to marriage, but to anything that was not war. He himself, facing a firing squad, would not understand too well the concatenation of the series of subtle but irrevocable accidents that brought him to that point. The death of Remedios had not produced the despair that he had feared. It was, rather, a dull feeling of rage that gradually dissolved in a solitary and passive frustration, similar to the one he had felt during the time he was resigned to living without a woman. He plunged into his work again, but he kept up the custom of playing dominoes with his father-in-law. In a house bound up in mourning, the nightly conversations consolidated the friendship between the two men. "Get married again, Aurelito," his father-in-law would tell him. "I have 6 daughters for you to choose from." On one occasion, on the eve of the elections, Don Apolinar Moscote returned from one of his frequent trips, worried about the political situation in the country. The liberals were determined to go to war. Since Aureliano at that time had very confused notions about the difference between conservatives and liberals, his father-in-law gave him some schematic lessons. The liberals, he said, were Freemasons, bad people, wanting to hang priests, to institute civil marriage and divorce, to recognize the rights of illegitimate children as equal to those of legitimate ones, and to cut the country up into a federal system that would take power away from the supreme authority. The conservatives, on the other hand, who had received their power directly from God, proposed the establishment of public order and family morality, They were the defenders of the faith of Christ, of the principle of authority, and were not prepared to permit the country to be broken down into autonomous entities. Because of his humanitarian feelings, Aureliano sympathized with the liberal attitude with respect to the rights of natural children, but in any case, he could not understand how people arrived at the extreme of waging war over things that could not be touched with the hand. It seemed an exaggeration to him that, for the elections, his father-in-law had them send 6 soldiers armed with rifles under the command of a sergeant to a town with no political passions. They not only arrived, but they went from house to house, confiscating hunting weapons, machetes, and even kitchen knives, before they distributed among males over 21 the blue ballots with the names of the conservative candidates and the red ballots with the names of the liberal candidates. On the eve of the elections, Don Apolinar Moscote himself read a decree that prohibited the sale of alcoholic beverages and the gathering together of more than 3 people who were not of the same family. The elections took place without incident. At 8 o'clock on Sunday morning, a wooden ballot box was set up in the square, which was watched over by the 6 soldiers. The voting was absolutely free, as Aureliano himself was able to attest, since he spent almost the entire day with his father-in-law, seeing that no one voted more than once. At 4 in the afternoon, a roll of drums in the square announced the closing of the polls, and Don Apolinar Moscote sealed the ballot box with a label crossed by his signature. That night, while he played dominoes with Aureliano, he ordered the sergeant to break the seal in order to count the votes. There were almost as many red ballots as blue, but the sergeant left only 10 red ones and made up the difference with blue ones. Then they sealed the box again with a new label, and the first thing on the following day it was taken to the capital of the province. "The liberals will go to war," Aureliano said. Don Apolinar concentrated on his domino pieces. "If you're saying that because of the switch in ballots, they won't," he said. "We left a few red ones in, so there won't be any complaints." Aureliano understood the disadvantages of being in the opposition. "If I were a liberal," he said, "I'd go to war because of those ballots." His father-in-law looked at him over his glasses. "Come now, Aurelito," he said. "If you were a liberal, even though you're my son-in-law, you wouldn't have seen the switching of the balance." What really caused indignation in the town was not the results of the elections, but the fact that the soldiers had not returned the weapons. A group of women spoke with Aureliano so that he could obtain the return of their kitchen knives from his father-in-law. Don Apolinar Moscote explained to him, in strictest confidence, that the soldiers had taken the weapons off as proof that the liberals were preparing for war. The cynicism of the remark alarmed him. He said nothing, but on a certain night when Herinaldo Marquez and Magnifico Bisbal were speaking with some other friends about the incident of the knives, they asked him if he was a liberal or a conservative. Aureliano did not hesitate. "If I have to be something, I'll be a liberal," he said, "because the conservatives are tricky." On the following day, at the urging of his friends, he went to see Dr. Alirio Nogueira, to be treated for a supposed pain in his liver. He did not even understand the meaning of the subterfuge. Dr. Alirio Nogueira had arrived in Macondo a few years before with a medicine chest of tasteless pills and a medical motto that convinced no one: "One nail draws another." In reality, he was a charlatan. Behind his innocent facade of a doctor without prestige, there was hidden a terrorist who, with his short-legged boots, covered the scars that 5 years in the stocks had left on his legs. Taken prisoner during the first Federalist adventure, he managed to escape to Curaçao disguised in the garment he detested most in this world, a cassock. At the end of a prolonged exile, stirred up by the exciting news that exiles from all over the Caribbean brought to Curaçao, he set out in a smuggler's schooner and appeared in Riohacha with the bottles of pills that were nothing but refined sugar and a diploma from the University of Leipzig that he had forged himself. He wept with disappointment. The Federalist fervor, which the exiles had pictured as a powder keg about to explode, had dissolved into a vague electoral illusion. Embittered by failure, yearning for a safe place where he could await old age, the false homeopath took refuge in Macondo. In the narrow, bottle-crowded room that he rented on one side of the square, he lived several years off the hopelessly ill who, after having tried everything, consoled themselves with sugar pills. His instincts of an agitator remained dormant as long as Don Apollinar Mascote was a figurehead. He passed the time remembering and fighting against asthma. The approach of the elections was the thread that led him once more to the skein of subversion. He made contact with the young people in the town, who lacked political knowledge, and he embarked on a stealthy campaign of instigation. The numerous red ballots that appeared in the box, and that were attributed by Don Apollinar Mascote to the curiosity that came from youth, were part of his plan. He made his disciples vote in order to show them that elections were a farce. "The only effective thing," he would say, "is violence." The majority of Aureliano's friends were enthusiastic over the idea of liquidating the conservative establishment, but no one had dared include him in the plans, not only because of his ties with the magistrate, but because of his solitary and elusive character. It was known, furthermore, that he had voted blue at his father-in-law's direction, so it was a simple matter of chance that he revealed his political sentiments, and it was purely a matter of curiosity, a caprice that brought him to visit the doctor for the treatment of a pain that he did not have. In the den that smelled of camphorated cobwebs, he found himself facing a kind of dusty iguana whose lungs whistled when he breathed. Before asking him any questions, the doctor took him to the window and examined the inside of his lower eyelid. "It's not there," Aureliano said, following what they told him. He pushed the tips of his fingers into his liver and added, "Here's where I have the pain that won't let me sleep." Then Dr. Nogueira closed the window with the pretext that there was too much sun, and explained to him, in simple terms, that it was a patriotic duty to assassinate conservatives. For several days Aureliano carried a small bottle of pills in his shirt pocket. He would take it out every 2 hours, put 3 pills in the palm of his hand, and popped them into his mouth for them to be slowly dissolved on his tongue. Don Apollinar Mascote made fun of his faith in homeopathy, but those who were in on the plot recognized another one of their people in him. Almost all of the sons of the founders were implicated, although none of them knew concretely what action they were plotting. Nevertheless, the day the doctor revealed the secret to Aureliano, the latter elicited the whole plan of the conspiracy. Although he was convinced at that time of the urgency of liquidating the conservative regime, the plot horrified him. Dr. Nogueira had a mystique of personal assassination. His system was reduced to coordinating a series of individual actions, which, in one masterstroke, covering the whole nation, would liquidate the functionaries of the regime, along with their respective families, especially the children, in order to exterminate conservatism at its roots. Don Apollinar Mascote, his wife, and his 6 daughters, needless to say, were on the list. "You're no liberal or anything else," Aureliano told him without getting excited. "You're nothing but a butcher." "In that case," the doctor replied with equal calm, "give me back the bottle. You don't need it anymore." Only 6 months later did Aureliano learn that the doctor had given up on him as a man of action because he was a sentimental person with no future, with a passive character, and a definite, solitary vocation. They tried to keep him surrounded, fearing that he would betray the conspiracy. Aureliano calmed them down. He would not say a word. But on the night they went to murder the Mascote family, they would find him guarding the door. He showed such a convincing decision that the plan was postponed for an indefinite date. It was during those days that Ursula asked his opinion about the marriage between Pietro Crespi and Amaranta, and he answered that these were not times to be thinking about such a thing. For a week he had been carrying an old-fashioned pistol under his shirt. He kept his eyes on his friends. In the afternoon he would go have coffee with Jose Arcadio and Rebecca, who had begun to put their house in order, and from 7 o'clock on he would play dominoes with his father-in-law. At lunchtime he was chatting with Arcadio, who was already a huge adolescent, and he found him more and more excited over the imminence of war. In school, where Arcadio had pupils older than himself, mixed in with children who were barely beginning to talk, the liberal fever had caught on. There was talk of shooting Father Nicanor, of turning the church into a school, of instituting free love. Aureliano tried to calm down his drive. He recommended discretion and prudence to him. Deaf to his calm reasoning, to his sense of reality, Arcadio reproached him in public for his weakness of character. Aureliano waited. Finally, in the beginning of December, Ursula burst into the workshop all upset.
War's broken out!
War, in fact, had broken out 3 months before. Martial law was in effect in the whole country. The only one who knew it immediately was Don Apollinar Moscote, but he did not give the news even to his wife, while the army platoon that was to occupy the town by surprise was on its way. They entered noiselessly before dawn, with two pieces of light artillery drawn by mules, and they set up their headquarters in the school. A 6 p.m. curfew was established. A more drastic search than the previous one was undertaken, house by house, and this time they even took farm implements. They dragged out Dr. Noguera, tied him to a tree in the square, and shot him without any due process of law. Father Nicanor tried to impress the military authorities with the miracle of levitation, and had his head split open by the butt of a soldier's rifle. The liberal exultation had been extinguished into a silent terror. Aureliano, pale, mysterious, continued playing dominoes with his father-in-law. He understood that, in spite of his present title of civil and military leader of the town, Don Apollinar Moscote was once more a figurehead. The decisions were made by the army captain, who each morning collected an extraordinary levy for the defense of public order. Four soldiers under his command snatched a woman who had been bitten by a mad dog from her family and killed her with their rifle butts. One Sunday, 2 weeks after the occupation, Aureliano entered Herinaldo Marquez's house and, with his usual terseness, asked for a mug of coffee without sugar. When the two of them were alone in the kitchen, Aureliano gave his voice an authority that had never been heard before. "Get the boys ready," he said. "We're going to war." Herinaldo Marquez did not believe him. "With what weapons?" he asked. "With theirs," Aureliano replied. Tuesday at midnight, in a mad operation, 21 men under the age of 30, commanded by Aureliano Buendia, armed with table knives and sharpened tools, took the garrison by surprise, seized the weapons, and in the courtyard executed the captain and the four soldiers who had killed the woman. That same night, while the sound of the firing squad could be heard, Arcadio was named civil and military leader of the town. The married rebels barely had time to take leave of their wives, whom they left to their own devices. They left at dawn, cheered by the people who had been liberated from the terror, to join the forces of the revolutionary general Victorio Medina, who, according to the latest reports, was on his way to Manaure. Before leaving, Aureliano brought Don Apollinar Moscote out of a closet. "Rest easy, father-in-law," he told him. "The new government guarantees on its word of honor your personal safety and that of your family." Don Apollinar Moscote had trouble identifying that conspirator in high boots and with a rifle slung over his shoulder with the person he had played dominoes with until 9 in the evening. "This is madness, Aurelito," he exclaimed. "Not madness," Aureliano said. "War. And don't call me Aurelito anymore. Now I'm Colonel Aureliano Buendia." Colonel Aureliano Buendia organized 32 armed uprisings, and he lost them all. He had 17 male children by 17 different women, and they were exterminated one after the other on a single night before the oldest one had reached the age of 35. He survived 14 attempts on his life, 73 ambushes, and a firing squad. He lived through a dose of strychnine in his coffee that was enough to kill a horse. He refused the Order of Merit, which the President of the Republic awarded him. He rose to be Commander-in-Chief of the Revolutionary Forces, with jurisdiction and command from one border to the other, and the man most feared by the government. But he never let himself be photographed. He declined the lifetime pension offered him after the war, and until old age he made his living from the little gold fishes that he manufactured in his workshop in Macondo. Although he always fought at the head of his men, The only wound that he received was the one he gave himself after signing the Treaty of Neerlandia, which put an end to almost 20 years of civil war. He shot himself in the chest with a pistol, and the bullet came out through his back without damaging any vital organ. The only thing left of all that was a street that bore his name in Macondo. And yet, as he declared a few years before he died of old age, he had not expected any of that on the dawn he left with his 21 men to join the forces of General Victorio Medina. "We leave Macondo in your care," was all that he said to Arcadio before leaving. "We leave it to you in good shape. Try to have it in better shape when we return." Arcadio gave a very personal interpretation to the instructions. He invented a uniform with the braid and epaulets of a marshal, inspired by the prince in one of Melquiades' books, and around his waist he buckled the saber with gold tassels that had belonged to the executed captain. He set up the 2 artillery pieces at the entrance to town, put uniforms on his former pupils, who had been aroused by his fiery proclamations, and let them wander through the streets armed in order to give outsiders an impression of invulnerability. It was a double-edged deception, for the government did not dare attack the place for 10 months, but when it did, it unleashed such a large force against it that resistance was liquidated in a half hour. From the first day of his rule, Arcadio revealed his predilection for decrees. He would read as many as 4 a day in order to decree and institute everything that came into his head. He imposed obligatory military service for men over 18, declared to be public property any animals walking the streets after 6 in the evening, and made men who were over age wear red armbands. He sequestered Father Nicanor in the parish house, under pain of execution, and prohibited him from saying mass or ringing the bells unless it was for a liberal victory. In order that no one would doubt the severity of his aims, he ordered a firing squad organized in the square and had it shoot at a scarecrow. At first, no one took him seriously. They were, after all, school children, playing at being grown-ups. But one night, when Arcadio went into Caterino's store, the trumpeter in the group greeted him with a fanfare that made the customers laugh, and Arcadio had him shot for disrespect for the authorities. People who protested were put on bread and water with their ankles in a set of stocks that he had set up in a schoolroom. "You murderer!" Ursula would shout at him every time she learned of some new arbitrary act. "When Aureliano finds out, he's going to shoot you, and I'll be the first one to be glad." But it was of no use. Arcadio continued tightening the tourniquet with unnecessary rigor until he became the cruelest ruler that Macondo had ever known. "Now let them suffer the difference," Don Apollinar Mascote said on one occasion. "This is the liberal paradise." Arcadio found out about it. At the head of a patrol, he assaulted the house, destroyed the furniture, flogged the daughters, and dragged out Don Apollinar Mascote. When Ursula burst into the courtyard of headquarters, after having gone through the town shouting shame and brandishing with rage a pitch-covered whip, Arcadio himself was preparing to give the squad the command to fire. "I dare you to, bastard!" Ursula shouted. Before Arcadio had time to react, she let go with the first blow of the lash. "I dare you to, murderer!" she shouted, "and kill me too, son of an evil mother. That way I won't have the eyes to weep for the shame of having raised a monster." Whipping him without mercy, she chased him to the back of the courtyard, where Arcadio curled up like a snail in its shell. Don Apollinar Mascote was unconscious, tied to the post where previously they had had the scarecrow that had been cut to pieces by shots fired in fun. The boys in the squad scattered, fearful that Ursula would go after them too, but she did not even look at them. She left Arcadio with his uniform torn, roaring with pain and rage, and she untied Don Apollinar Mascote and took him home. Before leaving the headquarters, she released the prisoners from the stocks. From that time on, she was the one who ruled in the town. She re-established Sunday Mass, suspended the use of red armbands, and abrogated the hare-brained decrees. But in spite of her strength, she still wept over her unfortunate fate. She felt so much alone that she sought the useless company of her husband, who had been forgotten under the chestnut tree. "Look what we've come to," she would tell him, as the June rains threatened to knock the shelter down.
"Look at the empty house. Our children scattered all over the world, and the two of us alone again, the same as in the beginning."
José Arcadio Buendía, sunk in an abyss of unawareness, was deaf to her lamentations. At the beginning of his madness, he would announce his daily needs with urgent Latin phrases. In fleeting, clear spells of lucidity, when Amaranta would bring him his meals, he would tell her what bothered him most, and would accept her sucking glasses and mustard plasters in a docile way. But at the time when Ursula went to lament by his side, he had lost all contact with reality. She would bathe him bit by bit, as he sat on his stool, while she gave him news of the family.
"Aureliano went to war more than 4 months ago, and we haven't heard anything about him," she would say, scrubbing his back with a soaped brush.
"José Arcadio came back a big man, taller than you, and all covered with needlework, but he only brought shame to our house." She thought she noticed, however, that her husband would grow sad with the bad news. Then she decided to lie to him.
"You won't believe what I'm going to tell you," she said, as she threw ashes over his excrement in order to pick it up with the shovel. "God willed that José Arcadio and Rebecca should get married, and now they're very happy."
She got to be so sincere in the deception that she ended up by consoling herself with her own lies.
"Arcadio is a serious man now," she said, "and very brave, and a fine-looking young man with his uniform and saber."
It was like speaking to a dead man, for José Arcadio Buendía was already beyond the reach of any worry. But she insisted. He seemed so peaceful, so indifferent to everything, that she decided to release him. He did not even move from his stool. He stayed there, exposed to the sun and the rain, as if the thongs were unnecessary, for a dominion superior to any visible bond kept him tied to the trunk of the chestnut tree. Toward August, when winter began to last forever, Ursula was finally able to give him a piece of news that sounded like the truth.
"Would you believe it, that good luck is still pouring down on us?" she told him.
"Amaranta and the Pianola Italian are going to get married." Amaranta and Pietro Crespi had, in fact, deepened their friendship, protected by Ursula, who this time did not think it necessary to watch over the visits. It was a twilight engagement. The Italian would arrive at dusk, with a gardenia in his buttonhole, and he would translate Petrarch's sonnets for Amaranta. They would sit on the porch, suffocated by the oregano and the roses, he reading and she sewing lace cuffs, indifferent to the shocks and bad news of the war, until the mosquitoes made them take refuge in the parlour. Amaranta's sensibility, her discreet but enveloping tenderness, had been weaving an invisible web about her fiancé, which he had to push aside materially with his pale and ringless fingers in order to leave the house at 8 o'clock. They had put together a delightful album with the postcards that Pietro Crespi received from Italy. They were pictures of lovers in lonely parks, with vignettes of hearts pierced with arrows and golden ribbons held by doves.
"I've been to this park in Florence," Pietro Crespi would say, going through the cards.
"A person can put out his hand and the birds will come to feed." Sometimes, over a watercolour of Venice, nostalgia would transform the smell of mud and putrefying shellfish of the canals into the warm aroma of flowers. Amaranta would sigh, laugh, and dream of a second homeland of handsome men and beautiful women who spoke a childlike language, with ancient cities, of whose past grandeur only the cats among the rubble remained. After crossing the ocean in search of it, after having confused passion with the vehement stroking of Rebecca, Pietro Crespi had found love. Happiness was accompanied by prosperity. His warehouse at that time occupied almost a whole block, and it was a hothouse of fantasy, with reproductions of the bell tower of Florence that told time with a concert of carillons, and music boxes from Sorrento and compacts from China that sang five-note melodies when they were opened, and all the musical instruments imaginable, and all the mechanical toys that could be conceived. Bruno Crespi, his younger brother, was in charge of the store, because Pietro Crespi barely had enough time to take care of the music school.
Thanks to him, the Street of the Turks, with its dazzling display of knick-knacks, became a melodic oasis, where one could forget Arcadio's arbitrary acts and the distant nightmare of the war. When Ursula ordered the revival of Sunday Mass, Pietro Crespi donated a German harmonium to the church, organized a children's chorus, and prepared a Gregorian repertory that added a note of splendor to Father Nicanor's quiet rite. No one doubted that he would make Amaranta a fortunate mate. Not pushing their feelings, letting themselves be borne along by the natural flow of their hearts, they reached a point where all that was left to do was set a wedding date. They did not encounter any obstacles. Ursula accused herself inwardly of having twisted Rebecca's destiny with repeated postponements, and she was not about to add more remorse. The rigor of the mourning for Remedios had been relegated to the background by the mortifications of the war, Aureliano's absence, Arcadio's brutality, and the expulsion of Jose Arcadio and Rebecca. With the imminence of the wedding, Pietro Crespi had hinted that Aureliano Jose, in whom he had stirred up a love that was almost filial, would be considered their oldest child. Everything made Amaranta think that she was heading toward a smooth happiness. But unlike Rebecca, she did not reveal the slightest anxiety. With the same patience with which she dyed tablecloths, sewed lace masterpieces, and embroidered needlepoint peacocks, she waited for Pietro Crespi to be unable to bear the urges of his heart and more. Her day came with the ill-fated October rains. Pietro Crespi took the sewing basket from her lap and told her, "We'll get married next month." Amaranta did not tremble at the contact with his icy hands. She withdrew hers like a timid little animal and went back to her work.
"Don't be simple, Crespi," she smiled. "I wouldn't marry you even if I were dead."
Pietro Crespi lost control of himself. He wept shamelessly, almost breaking his fingers with desperation. But he could not break her down.
"Don't waste your time,"
was all that Amaranta said.
"If you really love me so much, don't set foot in this house again."
Ursula thought she would go mad with shame. Pietro Crespi exhausted all manner of pleas. He went through incredible extremes of humiliation. He wept one whole afternoon in Ursula's lap, and she would have sold her soul in order to comfort him. On rainy nights he could be seen prowling about the house with an umbrella, waiting for a light in Amaranta's bedroom. He was never better dressed than at that time. His august head of a tormented emperor had acquired a strange air of grandeur. He begged Amaranta's friends, the ones who sewed with her on the porch, to try to persuade her. He neglected his business. He would spend the day in the rear of the store writing wild notes, which he would send to Amaranta with flower petals and dried butterflies, and which she would return unopened. He would shut himself up for hours on end to play the zither. One night he sang. Macondo woke up in a kind of angelic stupor that was caused by a zither that deserved more than this world, and a voice that led one to believe that no other person on earth could feel such love. Pietro Crespi then saw the lights go on in every window in town, except that of Amaranta. On November 2nd, All Souls' Day, his brother opened the store and found all the lamps lighted, all the music boxes opened, and all the clocks striking an interminable hour, and in the midst of that mad concert, he found Pietro Crespi at the desk in the rear, with his wrists cut by a razor, and his hands thrust into a basin of benzoin. Ursula decreed that the wake would be in her house. Father Nicanor was against a religious ceremony and burial in consecrated ground. Ursula stood up to him. "In a way that neither you nor I can understand, that man was a saint," she said. "So I am going to bury him against your wishes, beside Melchiades' grave." She did it with the support of the whole town and with a magnificent funeral. Amaranta did not leave her bedroom. From her bed she heard Ursula's weeping, the steps and whispers of the multitude that invaded the house, the wailing of the mourners, and then a deep silence that smelled of trampled flowers. For a long time she kept on smelling Pietro Crespi's lavender breath at dusk, but she had the strength not to succumb to delirium. Ursula abandoned her. She did not even raise her eyes to pity her on the afternoon when Amaranta went into the kitchen
and put her hand into the coals of the stove until it hurt her so much that she felt no more pain, but instead smelled the pestilence of her own singed flesh. It was a stupid cure for her remorse. For several days she went about the house with her hand in a pot of egg whites, and when the burns healed, it appeared as if the whites had also scarred over the sores on her heart. The only external trace that the tragedy left was the bandage of black gauze that she put on her burned hand and that she wore until her death. Arcadio gave a rare display of generosity by decreeing official mourning for Pietro Crespi. Ursula interpreted it as the return of the strayed lamb, but she was mistaken. She had lost Arcadio, not when he had put on his military uniform, but from the beginning. She thought she had raised him as a son, as she had raised Rebecca, with no privileges or discrimination. Nevertheless, Arcadio was a solitary and frightened child during the insomnia plague, in the midst of Ursula's utilitarian fervor, during the delirium of José Arcadio Buendía, the hermetism of Aureliano, and the mortal rivalry between Amaranta and Rebecca. Aureliano had taught him to read and write, thinking about other things, as he would have done with a stranger. He gave him his clothing so that Visitación could take it in when it was ready to be thrown away. Arcadio suffered from shoes that were too large, from his patched pants, from his female buttocks. He never succeeded in communicating with anyone better than he did with Visitación and Cataure in their language. Melquiades was the only one who really was concerned with him, as he made him listen to his incomprehensible texts and gave him lessons in the art of daguerreotype. No one imagined how much he wept in secret, and the desperation with which he tried to revive Melquiades with the useless study of his papers. The school, where they paid attention to him and respected him, and then power, with his endless decrees and his glorious uniform, freed him from the weight of an old bitterness. One night in Caterino's store, someone dared tell him, "You don't deserve the last name you carry." Contrary to what everyone expected, Arcadio did not have him shot. "To my great honor," he said, "I am not a Buendía." Those who knew the secret of his parentage thought that the answer meant that he too was aware of it, but he had really never been. Pilar Tenera, his mother, who had made his blood boil in the dark room, was as much an irresistible obsession for him as she had been first for José Arcadio, and then for Aureliano. In spite of her having lost her charms and the splendor of her laugh, he sought her out and found her by the trail of her smell of smoke. A short time before the war, one noon when she was later than usual in coming for her younger son at school, Arcadio was waiting for her in the room where he was accustomed to take his siesta, and where he later set up the stocks. While the child played in the courtyard, he waited in his hammock, trembling with anxiety, knowing that Pilar Tenera would have to pass through there. She arrived. Arcadio grabbed her by the wrist and tried to pull her into the hammock. "I can't, I can't," Pilar Tenera said in horror. "You can't imagine how much I would like to make you happy, but as God is my witness, I can't." Arcadio took her by the waist, with his tremendous hereditary strength, and he felt the world disappear with the contact of her skin. "Don't play the saint," he said. "After all, everybody knows that you're a whore." Pilar overcame the disgust that her miserable fate inspired in her. "The children will find out," she murmured. "It will be better if you leave the bar off the door tonight." Arcadio waited for her that night, trembling with fever in his hammock. He waited without sleeping, listening to the aroused crickets in the endless hours of early morning and the implacable telling of time by the curlews, more and more convinced that he had been deceived. Suddenly, when anxiety had broken down into rage, the door opened. A few months later, facing the firing squad, Arcadio would relive the wandering steps in the classroom, the stumbling against benches, and finally the bulk of a body in the shadows of the room and the breathing of air that was pumped by a heart that was not his. He stretched out his hand and found another hand with two rings on the same finger about to go astray in the darkness. He felt the structure of the veins, the pulse of its misfortune, and felt the damp palm with a lifeline cut off at the base of the thumb by the claws of death. Then he realized that this was not the woman he was waiting for, because she did not smell of smoke, but of flower lotion, and she had inflated, blind breasts with nipples like a man's, a sex as stony and round as a nut, and the chaotic tenderness of excited inexperience. She was a virgin, and she had the unlikely name of Santa Sofia de la Piedad. Pilar Ternera had paid her 50 pesos, half of her life savings, to do what she was doing. Arcadio had seen her many times working in her parents' small food store, but he had never taken a good look at her, because she had that rare virtue of never existing completely except at the opportune moment. But from that day on, he huddled like a cat in the warmth of her armpit. She would go to the school at siesta time, with the consent of her parents, to whom Pilar Ternera had paid the other half of her savings. Later on, when the government troops dislodged them from the place where they had made love, they did it among the cans of lard and sacks of corn in the back of the store. About the time that Arcadio was named civil and military leader, they had a daughter. The only relatives who knew about it were Jose Arcadio and Rebecca, with whom Arcadio maintained close relations at that time, based not so much on kinship as on complicity. Jose Arcadio had put his neck into the marital yoke. Rebecca's firm character, the veracity of her stomach, her tenacious ambition, absorbed the tremendous energy of her husband, who had been changed from a lazy, woman-chasing man into an enormous work animal. They kept a clean and neat house. Rebecca would open it wide at dawn, and the wind from the graveyard would come in through the windows and go out through the doors to the yard, and leave the whitewashed walls and furniture tanned by the saltpeter of the dead. Her hunger for earth, the clock, clock of her parents' bones, the impatience of her blood as it faced Pietro Crespi's passivity, were relegated to the attic of her memory. All day long she would embroider beside the window, withdrawn from the uneasiness of the war, until the ceramic pots would begin to vibrate in the cupboard, and she would get up to warm the meal, much before the appearance, first of the mangy hounds, and then of the colossus in leggings and spurs with a double-barreled shotgun, who sometimes carried a deer on his shoulder, and almost always a string of rabbits or wild ducks. One afternoon, at the beginning of his rule, Arcadio paid them a surprise visit. They had not seen him since they had left the house, but he seemed so friendly and familiar that they invited him to share the stew. Only when they were having coffee did Arcadio reveal the motive behind his visit. He had received a complaint against Jose Arcadio. It was said that he had begun by ploughing his own yard, and had gone straight ahead into neighboring lands, knocking down fences and buildings with his oxen, until he took forcible possession of the best plots of land around. On the peasants, whom he had not despoiled because he was not interested in their lands, he levied a contribution which he collected every Saturday with his hunting dogs and his double-barreled shotgun. He did not deny it. He based his right on the fact that the usurped lands had been distributed by Jose Arcadio Buendía at the time of the founding, and he thought it possible to prove that his father had been crazy ever since that time, for he had disposed of a patrimony that really belonged to the family. It was an unnecessary allegation, because Arcadio had not come to do justice. He simply offered to set up a registry office so that Jose Arcadio could legalize his title to the usurped land, under the condition that he delegate to the local government the right to collect the contributions. They made an agreement. Years later, when Colonel Aureliano Buendía examined the titles to property, he found registered in his brother's name all of the land between the hill where his yard was, on up to the horizon, including the cemetery, and discovered that during the 11 months of his rule, Arcadio had collected not only the money of the contributions, but had also collected fees from people for the right to bury their dead in Jose Arcadio's land. It took Ursula several months to find out what was already public knowledge, because people hid it from her so as not to increase her suffering. At first she suspected it. "Arcadio is building a house," she confided with feigned pride to her husband, as she tried to put a spoonful of calabash syrup into his mouth. Nevertheless, she involuntarily sighed and said, "I don't know why, but all this has a bad smell to me." Later on, when she found out that Arcadio had not only built a house, but had ordered some Viennese furniture, she confirmed her suspicions that he was using public funds. "You're the shame of our family name,"
she shouted at him one Sunday after Mass, when she saw him in his new house playing cards with his officers. Arcadio paid no attention to her. Only then did Ursula know that he had a 6-month-old daughter, and that Santa Sofia della Piedad, with whom he was living outside of marriage, was pregnant again. She decided to write to Colonel Aureliano Buendia, wherever he was, to bring him up to date on the situation.